From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Jane Clase, and this is Here and Now. The country's economy shrunk again this quarter, causing worries that a recession is already here. This time, business investment fell after rising last quarter. The report comes on the heels of yesterday's Federal Reserve rate hike, this time by 0.75 point. It's the latest in a series of increases the Fed hopes will slow down the economy and curtail inflation. So how might this play out, and what role can President Biden play in turning around the economy? Let's bring in Heather Boucher. She's a member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the news this morning that the U.S. economy shrank for a second straight quarter. Doesn't this indicate to you that we're moving closer to a recession?
Well, it certainly does indicate that the economy shrank in the second quarter. You know, when we're actually officially defining a recession, which is done by an independent entity called the National Bureau of Economic Research, they look at a wide range of economic indicators. So not just GDP, but also things like household employment, what's happening with payroll employment. And they're looking for everything to be going down at once. And the thing about this economy right now is that some indicators are still doing quite well. And then, you know, we need to look at the wide range of indicators, you know, including the fact that we continue to see this very robust pace of job gains in the economy, and we've not typically ever seen a recession start with such robust job gains.
It is a complex time for the economy, but isn't it true that consecutive quarters of a falling GDP is certainly an indicator, or at least a real warning, of recession to come?
It is certainly an indicator, and it's certainly one that we take very, very seriously. But, you know, again, we do need to look under the hood and, you know, look at what's going on with all of the components of GDP. You know, what we saw last month is that while, you know, certain indicators were not looking so good, at the same time, we did see that real consumer spending, which is about 70% of GDP, continued to rise. So I think we're not clear yet that we are in a recession, but certainly we are looking for an economy that gets back to a stable pace of growth as we recover from this historic pandemic.
So maybe the problem is the president has tried to persuade Americans that the economic recovery is stronger than people perceive it to be. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that we're in an economy where we've had these, you know, enormous challenges with businesses getting back to the work of what they do well in terms of the fragility of America's supply chains. And on top of that, you've had this inflation, most recently in large part driven by energy prices because of a war Putin is waging in the Ukraine. So while you've seen, you know, strong and steady job gains, very low unemployment, the inflation and the fact that, you know, especially gas is so expensive has been hard on families.
We've heard over and over from the White House that they don't think we're heading toward recession. Yesterday, the president said flat out, we're not going to be in a recession. But with the news this morning that the U.S. economy is shrinking, I mean, where is the evidence to back that up?
Well, I think you need to look at the range of economic indicators. We have not seen a recession start in a period where you were creating over 300,000 jobs per month on average. But also, let's be very clear, what is happening in this economy right now is that we are seeing this recovery as businesses have gotten back on track. And certainly we see this inflation, but we are not seeing the kind of widespread economic meltdown that we saw, for example, over a decade ago during the financial crisis.
Fed Chair Jerome Powell certainly is not ruling out a recession, but he says that the, quote, path to a soft landing has clearly narrowed. Powell did not rule out another rate increase at the next meeting in September. What do you see as the long-term impact of these rate hikes, and when might consumers actually feel the benefit of these actions?
Well, consumers are already seeing the effect of some of these actions. I mean, so first, I think it really is important to keep emphasizing the sharp reduction in gas prices around the country. But then certainly what the Fed is doing with raising interest rates, you know, has very quickly affected consumers, especially through mortgage rates. Mortgage rates have gone up markedly. That is having an effect on, you know, how people are looking at buying new homes. This is the kind of soft landing that the Fed is looking for, that you slow the economy down from this very, very fast sprint, trying to get everything back up and running really quickly, but then sort of go into this glide path.
Yes, you can say we're seeing a recovery on some level, but, you know, the average American is struggling. What does the White House say to them?
First, The president has been focused on doing what he can do to lower prices. Falling gas prices is certainly helping all those families struggling. But the other thing is that the president has been focused on working with Congress to pass legislation that would lower family costs. And that is why the bill that is literally in front of Congress today, two bills in front of Congress today, are so important to lower costs facing families for things like health care and energy costs. It is through that legislation that we can really make a difference for families.
That's economist Heather Boucher, a member of President Biden's Council of Economic Advisors. Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some local sheriffs are investigating election fraud, even if there is little evidence for it. One group is the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, and it has a broad view of sheriffs' authority on elections. Let's talk about this with Greg Champagne. He's former president of the National Sheriffs Association and sheriff of St. Charles Parish in Louisiana. Sheriff, you and your colleagues have a lot of power, for instance, to deputize people on the spot. Do they have the power to, say, seize voting machines if they suspect voting fraud?
Well, first off, let me change your wording here. I usually cringe when people say, you know, sheriffs are powerful or too powerful. I don't even like to use the word power. I like to use the word authority. Okay. And in particular, legal authority, which is based upon, you know, our state constitutions, our federal constitution, and local and state statutes. I only have the authority as a sheriff to act according to law and what the law allows me to do. As far as election fraud or any kind of fraud, I mean, we as chief law enforcement officers have the legal authority to investigate anything that if we believe there's reasonable grounds to believe a crime has occurred. In fact, we have a duty to do that. But I think a sheriff should be cautious before running out and creating an investigation without at least some viable information that a crime has occurred. And ultimately, it would be the decision of a county prosecutor, in our case, a district attorney, to review anything that we would investigate, as they do in any criminal charge, and decide whether or not to go to court and prosecute it.
What you're describing is a process where other officials, election officials, where there is some suspicion of something that might have gone awry, illegal, and then mentioning it to a sheriff to look into it. But in this case, do we have some organizations of sheriffs that on their own are saying, we're going to go and look for election fraud? Is that different?
This is not something that is certainly come on my radar. And I just recently attended, you know, our national conferences. I do all of them. In Kansas City, where we had literally hundreds of sheriffs, and the topic of urging anyone to go out and investigate election fraud from 2 years ago was really not a topic of conversation. With that said, obviously there are those and the individuals and people that still continue to, you know, have anxiety and distress over the 2020 election. I think a sheriff needs to, you know, if there is credible evidence that a crime has occurred, and that could be any type of crime, then we should investigate it if there's some reasonable cause to believe something had occurred. I don't typically go out and wake up in the morning and say, let's see, I haven't had any reports of any burglaries today. Let me go out and go door to door and see if anybody's been burglarized.
Right, right.
So, you know, we kind of wait until we get a complaint.
As you know, as you may know, the sheriff in Johnson County, Kansas, has been looking into what he calls 200 tips alleging fraud in local elections. He's been talking about questioning the use of ballot boxes. How much authority in cases like these do you think sheriffs have or should have?
I'm not really familiar with what's going on in that particular state, but I do know the law. I am an attorney. I chair our legal affairs committee. I used to be a prosecutor as well for years. So I do know that, you know, in order to go in and seize evidence, we need to have probable cause and a search warrant to do so. So, okay. I mean, if that exists, then that would make it appropriate.
You know, stepping back, sheriffs have a certain status in American society. And I wonder, given some of these groups, not your group, but some of these smaller groups that are moving into this space, that say they're moving into this space, I wonder if you worry about sheriffs potentially moving into this space of promoting misinformation.
Well, no sheriffs that I am certainly friends with believe in going out and promoting misinformation. The opposite is true. I think, you know, we have roughly 3,080 plus elected sheriffs around the country. And And like any group, you have, and I think the overwhelming majority of sheriffs are honorable public servants whose sole mission and what they wake up every morning trying to do is what I try to do is try to keep my people as safe as possible and enforce my laws as fairly and as evenly as possible. But I mean, there are always a minority who maybe, you know, end up involving in themselves in certain activities. You know, you always read unfortunate stories. A sheriff goes to jail for taking a bribe or something like that. And that's hurtful to us all. So I think I would urge any sheriff to make sure that you're acting within law, that you are, you know, respecting the Bill of Rights of the Constitution, making sure you have probable cause to conduct investigations, which is, you know, basics. You know, it's sheriffing 101, mm-hmm. law enforcement 1.
That's Greg Champagne, former president of the National Sheriffs Association and sheriff of St. Charles Parish in Louisiana. Sheriff, thanks for the time.
Well, thank you.
In the past few weeks, deadly heat waves have wrought havoc across Europe, China, and here in the United States. Many countries experienced new record highs, some reaching above 110 degrees Fahrenheit for days at a time. The damage of increasing heat waves is bad enough on land, but the picture is even worse offshore. A new study shines a light on the damage that warming oceans does to kelp forests, one of the most vital and dynamic ecosystems in the world. One of the co-authors of this report is coastal biologist Samuel Starko, who is a postdoctorate fellow at the University of Victoria. Sam, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
These kelp forests are such important ecosystems. Tell us where you find them around the world.
Sure, yeah. So kelp forests are found around approximately one-third of the world's coastline. So they're actually very common and abundant ecosystems. We find them mostly in temperate environments, so sort of they like cool or even colder water, and there are a whole bunch of different species that look completely different, really, depending on where you are in the world.
One-third of the world's coastline have kelp forests. That's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. And, you know, it's really one of the, if not the most common coastal ecosystem that we have. So if we compare it to other marine habitats like seagrass meadows or like coral reefs, it's actually the most common of those sort of type of marine habitats. We find them in Europe. We find them here in North America on both the West and East Coast. We find them in Asia, in South America, Australia, really all over the world.
And what's happening underwater to these kelp forests because the waters are warming?
Yeah, so that really depends on where exactly you're looking. But what we are seeing is in some of the places that are towards the edge of temperatures that kelp can actually tolerate, we're seeing kelp start to disappear. So they're negatively impacted by these warm temperatures and they start to disappear. In places like the Arctic, though, where it's actually a little bit too cold for kelp, we're kind of expecting the opposite, where kelp might actually start to do well under those warmer conditions.
Tell us what causes a marine heat wave. Is it direct heat from the sun? Is it human activity as well? What's the cause?
So there are a few different processes that can lead to marine heat waves. One that a lot of listeners might be familiar with is the El Nino cycle. So these are these natural cycles that just create these warm conditions periodically. And these are actually becoming sort of more extreme and more intense as the climate continues to warm. There are other processes such as, you know, high pressure weather systems where you do have this direct heating of the water by the sun. But as a whole, what we're seeing is that these marine heat waves are becoming more common and more intense and just sort of causing more and more damage each time they occur.
And why should people be so concerned specifically about these kelp forests that you've studied?
Kelp forests provide habitat for a whole wide range of species. So a lot of the fisheries that we depend on, whether that's herring or salmon, the kelp actually provide the physical habitat for those organisms. And so without the kelp there, they don't have really as good a place to live. The kelp also fix a lot of sugars. So much like plants on land photosynthesize and produce sugars that are consumed by other organisms, kelp do the same in the ocean.
So you're saying there's a real domino effect here. When the kelp goes, so does much of the ecosystem in the ocean itself.
Yeah, we certainly see that in a number of places that all of these kelp-dependent species start to decline or disappear completely.
So aside from this report, how much damage is being done right now in the oceans by these heat waves that we've seen this summer? And in general, the rising temperatures we've been experiencing because of climate change?
I would say that marine heat waves are one of the major ways that we're seeing direct impacts of warming on our ocean ecosystems. We're seeing these impacts on coral reefs, on seagrass meadows, direct impacts on fisheries, as well as, you know, kelp forests, which I'm more familiar with.
So coral reefs, seagrass meadows, kelp forests, how catastrophic is this? Where are we on the path down the road to, you know, destruction of some of these really important species within the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some places we've already seen irreversible change where with this major marine heat wave happened maybe 5-10 years ago and there hasn't been any recovery, and it's not clear that there will be recovery. In some places, these heat waves may sort of just be starting to have their impacts. And so it really remains to be seen how widespread these impacts will continue to be and you know, whether some of these ecosystems might be able to be returned to their sort of quote-unquote natural state. But I think we are seeing some pretty severe impacts in ecosystems like kelp forests, like coral reefs. You know, you've probably heard of coral bleaching, which can cause this major irreversible damage to coral reefs. So I think really in some places and after some of these major events, we see some pretty profound impacts that really, I think, go above and beyond a lot of the other impacts that we're seeing from more gradual warming of climate change.
Well, we rely on the ocean so much. It helps regulate temperature. It's a source of food for many of us, of course. From your perspective here, if ocean warming continues unchecked, what impact does that have on our way of life in the long term?
Well, I think certainly our way of life could be largely impacted in terms of sort of the foods we eat, a lot of the things that we do for fun, whether we are out fishing recreationally, you know, interacting with our environment in all these different ways. But I think food is really a major one. Fisheries are a huge part of how we feed ourselves here in North America, but also in a lot of the developing world. And so as these ecosystems start to feel these severe impacts of climate change and of marine heat waves, I think we could see the downfall of some of these fisheries leading to some very serious food availability impacts.
That is coastal biologist Samuel Starko, co-author of a recently released report on the damage of marine heat waves on kelp forests and the ramifications of ocean heating. Sam, thanks so much for your work and for speaking with us today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
The suspect accused of opening fire in Highland Park, Illinois, at that 4th of July parade, has been indicted on 117 felony charges. 7 people were shot dead that day, and dozens of others wounded. For the survivors and the loved ones of the victims, the recovery is just beginning. Susie Ahn of member station WBEZ reports.
Nubia Hogan can't help but repeatedly return to photos her sister took of the July 4th parade in Highland Park a few weeks ago. They were selfies and group photos of the family smiling together. Moments after they were taken, gunfire and carnage. The images are haunting now, as smiles dress the faces of those shot, some no longer with us. Hogan's father, Eduardo Uvaldo, was one of them.
He would joke around, he would dance, you know, for the kids. He was a hardworking man. He worked really hard so that he can give us a good life.
Hogan says her father was a loving family man. He would have turned 70 the week of the parade. He was adored by his grandkids, especially Hogan's 5-year-old nephew, who's taking his death really hard.
We catch him crying, you know, by himself. And it's heartbreaking. He just has, like, meltdowns.
Other family members were injured during the Highland Park parade, including Hogan's mother, who had shrapnel wounds to the head, and her 13-year-old son, who was shot in the arm. Both were treated and released the same day, but they're struggling emotionally. In all, 7 people were fatally shot and dozens were left injured and traumatized. Experts say the road to recovery could be long and strong support is necessary. In the aftermath of this shooting, there's a flood of resources. That rarely happens in communities where shootings are more common but are just as deadly. Tanya Zacherson is a trauma surgeon at the University of Chicago. She sees victims of gun violence regularly, and she says it's like treating war injuries.
For every person who's, you know, killed by firearm violence, there's anywhere between 5, 6, or 7 survivors who have been shot.
Zacherson says it's hard for a patient to hear about their life-altering injury, and it's extremely difficult to tell a family that a loved one has died.
The ripple effect of gun violence in terms of recovery, it's not just a difficult road of recovery for the individual patient. It's difficult for the entire family. It's difficult for the entire community.
That's the case for Hogan's husband, who stayed back with her father after the shooting. He keeps replaying the moments in his mind, feeling guilty that he couldn't do more to save him.
Give yourself compassion and permission to feel this way give yourself compassion and permission to say, you know, I survived.
Zonya Mathis Denizulu is a professor at the University of Chicago and says it's normal for survivors and witnesses to relive those moments and feel guilty. And those challenges are compounded for marginalized families, like those whom Denizulu works with.
Our families are not only dealing with those issues, but they're dealing with other structural inequities that can exacerbate their condition, which makes the progress for recovery from trauma extremely difficult. So we're very used to handling this. Unfortunately, I would like to work ourselves out of a business, but we're not there yet.
Bill Andrew is a former FBI agent who now works to prevent violence through an organization he co-founded. Back in 1988, Andrew was a 20-year-old student home from college. His family was held hostage not far from Highland Park. And in an attempt to disarm the shooter, Andrew was shot, his lungs and esophagus punctured. He says he survived in large part because of access to great health care and community support. Andrew wants to see strict background checks and a ban on assault weapons, but he also says there needs to be therapy, mentoring, and job training, supports that help get at the root causes of violence.
The biggest differentiator is that those systems are obviously healthier in resourced communities than they are in under-resourced communities. We need to do more to create equity there.
He says a survivor's recovery is difficult and long, but what helped him was his advocacy. Nubia Hogan says she's fortunate that so many family members are close by to support each other, but it's those quiet moments that are the worst.
When I'm alone, it's like I really get a lot of anxiety.
Hogan has had nightmares of that day, something that she says no one should have to endure. For Here and Now, I'm Susie Ahn.
After a lot of back and forth, a big change is about to land in the U.S. airline industry. This morning, JetBlue announced it had reached a deal to buy Spirit Airlines. Just yesterday, Spirit shareholders turned down a merger offer from Frontier. The decision ends one of the industry's biggest corporate love triangles and paves the way for JetBlue to become the fifth largest airline in the country. Here and Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now for more. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jane.
Well, it's been quite the 24 hours for Spirit. Tell us how this deal finally came about after weeks of delays.
Yeah, even someone who doesn't care about airlines, but just likes reality TV, like you said, a love triangle, right?
Right.
Maybe an episode of The Bachelorette or something, right? The object of affection, as you said, Spirit, Frontier and JetBlue both wanted it. Essentially, Frontier no longer was in the running. Shareholders wanted Spirit to do a deal with JetBlue because JetBlue was offering more money. Spirit's board was worried that a deal with JetBlue wouldn't pass regulatory muster, but in the end, that's the deal that got done here. And you knew once they said Frontier was no longer in the running that the only alternative was JetBlue. But that might have just been the easy part for JetBlue, because now it's about convincing regulators that this deal is not bad for consumers.
Right. So tell us more about the hurdles that may lie ahead.
Right. Well, JetBlue is a larger airline than Spirit. It's an airline that overlaps a lot with Spirit in terms of its network. Both of these airlines fly a lot between the Northeast and Florida, for example. JetBlue with a product that customers tend to like more, but also with higher fares, and that's the concern here. The Department of Justice is already suing JetBlue in relation to an alliance it has with American Airlines, where they're cooperating in the Northeast, places like Boston. And now you add to that JetBlue attempting to acquire Spirit. The question is what happens to airfares. Regulators clearly are worried. JetBlue, by the way, has positioned this as the opposite. They say this is not about reducing competition. This is about creating another strong competitor against the even more dominant airlines, basically saying Spirit and JetBlue alone can't compete against the giant airlines, but together they can.
I see. So you mentioned the impact on airfares. What does this mean for travelers?
Well, it depends on where you live. You know, if you live in one of those places where right now JetBlue and Spirit are both options, let's say you're flying between New York and Florida, for example. Mm-hmm. There will be one fewer airline. There's no denying that, even though, again, JetBlue says that wouldn't cause fares to go up. The history has been that, you know, when airlines merge, the immediate impact is, less competition. Same thing happens in any industry, maybe an upward pressure on airfares, even though over time, despite all the airline consolidation we've seen, airfares in real terms adjusted for inflation tend to go down.
Interesting. So either one of these mergers would have made the resulting airline the fifth largest U.S. carrier. So in our last 30 seconds here, put this into context for us. How's this going to change the landscape, change the industry?
Yeah, well, first of all, right, you've got United, Delta, American, the big three global airlines, Southwest, far larger than anyone else. Right now, it's Alaska after them. Alaska, which several years ago merged with Virgin America, which, oh, by the way, JetBlue wanted to buy.
Yes,
so this time it comes out on top. And yeah, so JetBlue and Spirit together. But this giant ultra low cost airline, Spirit, that a lot of people like the fares, even if they don't like the lack of legroom and all the extra charges, going away as an independent airline.
Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
In many states, lawmakers have been busy, making it harder to vote if it's in their party's interest, or redrawing maps of congressional districts, again, if it helps their party. But in these cases of gerrymandering, where's the check on the power of state legislatures? It turns out federal courts cannot strike down partisan gerrymandering. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 3 years ago. So, who's left to ensure free and fair elections? Well, state courts might be nudged out of the way, too, under a new case that will come before the U.S. Supreme Court this fall. It's complicated. The good news is we have Rick Hassan here to walk us through it. He teaches election law at UCLA. Rick, hi again.
Great to be with you.
Walk us through the essentials of this case.
Sure. Well, it's not new in North Carolina that their state legislature, which is called the General Assembly, engages in partisan gerrymandering. When they're drawing district lines, they're doing so to favor the party in power. People who don't like that have gone to court, and they've raised that it violates the United States Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, or some other part of the Constitution, to draw lines in this way because it favors one party over another. And a few years ago, the United States Supreme Court shut that down.
Okay, Rick, just to be clear, they cut federal courts out of this gerrymandering space. So now, for groups in North Carolina who oppose these redrawn congressional maps and say they're too partisan, where could they bring their complaints?
So the new attack is, well, let's go to state court and let's argue partisan gerrymandering violates the state constitution. So in the latest round of redistricting, the North Carolina General Assembly did another partisan gerrymander, and the state Supreme Court said it violates the state constitution. And now the General Assembly has gone to the United States Supreme Court and said, wait a minute, the state courts don't have the power to call what we're doing a gerrymander when we're doing it in congressional elections, because the Constitution gives us total power to do whatever we want, regardless of what the state constitution says.
So this would undercut the power of state courts to overrule what state lawmakers do.
What it does is it shifts power from the state courts to the state legislature. Mm-hmm. And that's really relevant here because the state legislature in North Carolina is dominated by Republicans. And the state Supreme Court has a majority of justices who are supported by Democrats. And the U.S. Supreme Court has already said the federal courts can't get involved in policing gerrymandering. So the one thing that could put a brake on this gerrymandering is the state Supreme Court. And this would shut that down.
Is there an important distinction here between political gerrymandering and what's called racial gerrymandering?
Yes. So if you draw district lines to favor one racial group over another, that could potentially be unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution. The court has said making race too important in drawing district lines is unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, which puts some states in a really tough position because there's a federal law called the Voting Rights Act that requires you to be race conscious when you draw district lines. And so on the one hand, you've got to take race into account, but if you take it into account too much, you could be violating the federal constitution. But if you favor your political party, well, that might be just okay. What that ignores is that there's a great correlation, a place like North Carolina, between race and party. About 90% of African-American voters are registered as Democrats. Mm-hmm. About 65-70% of white voters in North Carolina are registered Republicans.
State lawmakers, they're not just redrawing maps of districts. They're limiting access to the ballot box. Less mail-in, less early voting. And they stand to benefit from this legal argument we're talking about, which I gather is known as the independent state legislature theory. So what happens to electoral democracy if they win in the Supreme Court?
So if the Supreme Court of the United States adopts a very strong reading of this so-called independent state legislature theory, it would mean that state legislatures would be empowered. And to the extent that state legislatures are really trying to maximize their political power by doing things like gerrymandering, by imposing rules that make it harder for people to vote, what you're really doing is taking away the few limitations on their power. And so what it could mean is a shift towards more restrictive laws. And also in states like California, where I am, or Arizona or Michigan, places that have created independent redistricting commissions by initiative, by voters voting, well, those could be called into question too, because maybe that also is taking away the power of the state legislature.
So just stepping back for the listener who's not following some of these questions and some of these cases, what is the voter to make of this case going up to the Supreme Court?
Well, until the Supreme Court resolves this, this is kind of a shadow hanging over all rulings of state courts as to how federal elections should be conducted. Four justices on the Supreme Court already have indicated in earlier rulings that they're somewhat sympathetic to this argument. And so I think everybody's going to be watching to see how far the court is going to go. It's hearing another major Voting Rights Act case this term. Put all these cases together, and there's really a question as to how much the Supreme Court is out there protecting American democracy, how much they're going to let politicians do whatever they want to try to manipulate the rules to help them in office.
Rick Hassan, UCLA, thank you so much once again.
My pleasure.
Investigators in Japan are still looking into the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and that's drawing attention to the relationship between the suspected killer's family, Japanese politicians, and the Unification Church. We get more now from NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Tokyo.
The King of Kings and the officiators for the Black...
The Unification Church has been known for its mass wedding ceremonies.
The Reverend Dr. Sun Myung-moon...
And its former leader, Reverend Sun Myung-moon, a self-proclaimed messiah. Japanese and foreign politicians, including ex-Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, have recorded messages of support for the church. In honoring Dr. Hak Ja-han Moon and all of you, he said, I would like to express my profound thanks for your tireless efforts in resolving disputes in the world. Hak Ja-han Moon is the church's current leader and the widow of Reverend Sun Myung-moon, who founded the church in South Korea in 1954. Japanese media report that the suspected assassin decided to kill Abe after watching his videotaped message. 41-year-old Tetsuya Yamagami said he held a two-decade-long grudge against the church. He claims his mother donated more than $700,000 to it, bankrupting his family. The church was quick to distance itself.
Yamagami...
As for the motive for suspect Yamagami's crime and the donation issue reported by the media, we'd like to refrain from discussing it, as the case is under police investigation.
Tomihiro Tanaka, president of the Japan branch of the church, told the press that Yamagami wasn't a church member, but his mother was. Ties between the Unification Church and Japanese politicians go back decades. Abe's grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi, who was prime minister in the late 1950s, helped to set up the Japanese branch of an anti-communist group with links to the church.
They established a federation for victory over communism, and Kishi supported it. And this situation laid the foundation for Abe's assassination.
Hiromi Shimada is an expert on religion at Tokyo Women's Christian University. He says that the church has long provided volunteers to help Abe's Liberal Democratic Party at election time. Although Abe himself was not a member, he has praised the church's work. Many of his party's politicians, Shimada says, have turned a blind eye to allegations against the church.
They plant fear in you, saying that you're full of sin and corrupted. You'll end up in hell, and your family will face a similar fate.
This former member writes under the pen name of Fumiaki Tada because he says the church targets its critics. He claims the church duped him into joining, brainwashed him, and conned him out of money. In addition to the sins of Adam and Eve, Tada says, church members are taught about the sins of Japan's colonial rule over Korea in the early 20th century.
We were told that we must make up for it with money. So for the church's South Korean headquarters, the Japan branch is their wallet.
Tada won his lawsuit against the church. That helped him come to grips with his ordeal and share his experiences with fellow plaintiffs. But he said that's an outlet Abe's suspected killer never had.
He was the child of a believer, and he had nobody to talk to. This is one of the reasons he committed the crime, and I feel sorry for that.
Prosecutors will seek a mental evaluation to see whether Yamagami can be held criminally responsible for his actions. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Tokyo.
It's unclear how many farmers in the U.S. belong to the LGBTQ community. The government does not include them in their census, but many are making a point to be visible in their rural communities. Catherine Wheeler of Iowa Public Radio reports.
At Shea Peshek and Anna Hankins' farm in eastern Iowa, the chickens are coming out of the greenhouse into the sunshine after a rainy morning. The women are gearing up to do the day's chores. Peshek's life now is one she couldn't envision for herself as a kid. Growing up here on her family's farm, she didn't know any LGBTQ people in agriculture.
I really didn't feel like that was an option for me, so I thought, oh, for me to be out and have a wife and have like this out relationship or like to even find and date someone, that I needed to move to a city. So that's what I did.
But 8 years later, agriculture called her back to Iowa from San Diego. She then met Hankins, who had moved from the East Coast to work on a farm. Together, they started Over the Moon Farm and Flowers in 2019 and sell meat and flowers directly to consumers. Peshek says now she and Hankins are the examples, especially for LGBTQ people who can't or don't want to leave, that you can live and be connected in a rural community.
There's a lot of people that will tell us like, oh, I showed my queer relative, you know, your page, and they were really excited to know that you existed.
It's hard to know how many LGBTQ farmers there are in the U.S. The USDA doesn't include sexual orientation or gender identity in its census of agriculture, as it does with other demographic information like race. Catherine Densman, an assistant professor of rural sociology and public policy at Iowa State University, is trying to get a better sense of the numbers. She and a research team analyzed the 2017 Ag Census data.
We looked at men married to men and found about 8,300 farms that were run by men married to men. And that accounts for about almost 1% of all two producer farms. And then for women married to women, it was a lot lower. We found about 3,500, which is about like 0.4%.
But Densman says that's a significant undercount since the study only focused on two producer farms. She says knowing numbers is important so that LGBTQ farmers can get resources and support. One struggle LGBTQ people can face in rural areas is finding a queer community, and that's not different for farmers. Hannah Breckbill says back in 2018, she was having a hard time finding people who were queer and understood farming, so a friend encouraged her to build her own community. She started an annual event on her farm in northeast Iowa called the Queer Farmer Convergence. This year, the gathering takes place in early September. There's local food, workshops, and a dance party.
The point of it is to see my people and to be seen and understood as a whole person by the people who share a lot of experiences with me. And then also to be challenged by my people.
Breckbill says she wants to use her position as a landowner for justice. Her farm, Humble Hands Harvest, with pigs, lamb, and vegetables, is a worker-owned cooperative. She says the co-op is working to reduce barriers to get started in farming.
Queer people have had to buck systems that don't work for us. But because of that experience of like bucking those systems, we are good at bucking other systems.
That's something researchers have noticed about LGBTQ farmers. Michaela Hoffelmeyer is a PhD candidate in rural sociology at Penn State University. They say not all farmers in the LGBTQ community take a queer approach to farming, but those that do often challenge assumptions and norms of the existing ag system.
They're actively creating solutions to issues in the food system, such as hunger, food insecurity, malnutrition, and they're doing this with less resources.
Rock Steady Farm in Millerton, New York, for example, has been addressing food insecurity. The farm offers a sliding scale and payment plans that make it easier for more people of underserved backgrounds to buy their produce. Hoffelmeyer says there are enough LGBTQ people who want to farm and offer these kinds of solutions, but discrimination often keeps them from getting into farming in the first place.
They are specifically having to go through issues like, where can I live safely? What kind of farmers markets can I go to where people won't make assumptions or judgments about me? Where can I go and access farming resources? So all of these things are being shaped by how they are even seeing their opportunities in farming.
Hoffelmeyer says all of this means agriculture misses out on much needed farmers. They say LGBTQ farmers like those at Over the Moon and Humble Hands are working through the challenges and paving the way for others to do so as well. For Here and Now, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Catherine's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a collaboration that reports on food and agriculture in the Midwest. And we'd like your help with a story we're working on. Inflation is sending prices through the roof for just about everything, and many of us are changing our budgets and adjusting our plans. If you find the rising cost of gas, food, rent, travel, and other items changing how you shop and spend your money, we'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org to share your story. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Scott Tong in the Boston studio right next to you. It's Here and Now.